Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Americans are fascinated by the mystique of criminal investigations. Books, movies, TV shows, and even board games about whodunit mysteries have popularized the challenge and intrigue of catching criminals and solving crimes. But real life is not a TV show, and investigators understand that solving crimes, sometimes even years after they are committed, is serious business, an important way to prevent future crime, increase public safety, and maintain public trust in policing. Solving cases from homicides to robberies, missing persons, and more can also mean closure for victims and their families, many of whom wait years for answers and justice served. Some crimes are unintentional, others are meticulously planned, right down to the last detail. Whether a case is new or many years old, it takes knowledge, skill, determination, and a heavy dose of courage to seek out those who commit crimes and hold them responsible for their actions. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we'll explore the complex world of criminal investigation, what it takes to solve difficult cases, and the role of changing technology. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. Greg Bean started his career with the Marathon County Sheriff's Department in 1990 as a deputy. He worked his way through the ranks, eventually becoming a captain. Throughout the years, he worked on hundreds, even thousands of cases, from missing persons to robberies, homicides, and more. Now retired, Captain Bean is with us today to share his expertise as a seasoned investigator. Greg, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you.
Detective Dennis Blazer also retired from the Marathon County Sheriff's Department after many years in law enforcement. In November, Sheriff Scott Parks issued a commendation to Detective Blazer for his work tying a longtime suspect to the August 2006 murder of Kanyedis. It's a case that remained unsolved for well over a decade. In the sheriff's statement announcing the commendation, Scott Parks noted Detective Blazer's dedication, his drive, and his incomprehensible tenacity, working with the evidence at hand, which eventually led to a trial and conviction in the case. Dennis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'd like to start with the conviction of Cindy Schultz-Yedis, who a jury found guilty of killing her husband, Ken, at their rural Marathon County home in 2006. Cindy was convicted last year, but I will point out she is appealing or planning to appeal that conviction, so we're not going to get into too many fine details about the case. But in general, Dennis, you were assigned this case long after it was committed, but Greg, you never let go of this case. I remember interviewing you several years ago, and you were passionate about this. You wanted justice, especially for Ken's mother. Tell me what it felt like when an arrest was finally made in that case.
It was unbelievable, even though it was reality. And it was a long time to, I guess I can say, build the right team to make it come to fruition. And it did. There was no doubt in my mind that we were looking at the right person. Unfortunately, it took numerous investigators to go through bits and pieces of the case and every one of them came out and said, yes, this is the one, and to finish all of their leads, and it came to a successful conviction, and justice was served for the family, especially Margaret, who has been dealing with this since 2006, and I hope the family, including Margaret, or especially Margaret, has some closure to this case.
Dennis, what was the reaction from family when you were finally able to say, we made an arrest in this case?
It was kind of mixed, because one, it's their loved one who died, but then there was a lot of satisfaction, a lot of joy that there was somebody finally charged and convicted within this case.
So, Greg, let's go back a bit. You were one of the many officers who personally worked on this case over the years. What made you decide to assign the case to Dennis?
Well, you pretty much named it in reading Scott Parks or Sheriff Parks' commendation to Dennis. I called him a bulldog. He never quits. He goes after things. He's very well experienced in this field. He's been around forever. He's very highly trained. He has so many of these capabilities to work a case like this that it was kind of a no-brainer to get Dennis on board and see this case through. And I was hoping for the outcome that we have and not hoping for the outcome that we had with other investigators and other agencies assigned to this case. So it worked out well. Dennis was, like I said, it was a no-brainer. He's top-notch.
Dennis, what was it like to pick up the pieces of such a major investigation so long after the crime was committed? How challenging and daunting did that feel to you?
I didn't realize how much work it was going to be when Greg first asked me if I wanted to do this. But I also took it as an honor that he would ask me to do it, and it was also a challenge that I wanted to do that once it was assigned to me.
What are some of the reasons that it's harder to solve a case after the time has gone by? What factors make it more complicated, Dennis, when you're going through all the evidence years later?
You have to read all of the documents, all of the reports, try to piece together everything that happened, everything that was done, try to figure out what else you need to do.
Greg, how important is a fresh set of eyes when it comes to an investigation like this?
It's very important. In fact, it's probably the priority in cases like this. You know, for cold cases, a lot of success comes from new technology and things like that, but you can never forget about the basics investigative part of it, the field work, the interviews and interrogations and the footwork put into it. That's the main priority in working a case like this. And Dennis isn't afraid to work extra hours and put in a lot of time to which a case like this needs. And he did it. So
most of us might call this a cold case because so much time has gone by, but Greg, you were adamant that you never considered this a cold case. What did you mean by that?
I never did, because it was never, I call them shelved. This case was never put on a shelf and let go. It was always assigned. It was always being worked on. And I can say in my 20 years in the investigations, since 2006, when this case came in, this case was worked, and Dennis probably would agree with me, on a weekly, if not daily basis. So it really, I know it fits the definition of a cold case, but to me, it never was a cold case. We never left it go cold. It was always on our minds and being worked on. And if anything, it was a hot case, not a cold case.
How frustrating is it, Dennis, for families of victims when cases like this stretch on for years? How frustrating is it for families and for investigators when you're just trying to put that last piece of the puzzle together and it's just not fitting?
Well, of course, they want justice for their family member. They always want to know who was responsible for hurting their loved one.
How much of a team effort are these types of major investigations, Greg? I mean, it's not just one person.
It's not. It is a team. And this team aligned very well, worked together great, put in the long hours. It was the perfect team to get assigned to a case like this, including the start with Dennis and the district attorney's office and the attorney general's office. The right people were assigned to this case, and that's a huge part of why it came to a successful resolution.
Dennis, tell me a little bit about the relationship between the people who investigate crimes and prosecutors. Not just in this case, but in other cases as well, officers can arrest suspects, but ultimately, who decides whether or not this goes to trial?
Ultimately, it's the prosecutors. Because our standard of proof to arrest and charge, or to charge and arrest somebody, is probable cause. But the prosecutors, they have to be able to, they have to believe that they can win at trial.
So the standard is higher.
Yeah, their standard's a lot higher.
What are the conversations like between investigators and prosecutors when you're when you're saying, I've got this case solved, and they're saying, I don't know if I have enough? What is that like? What goes through your mind, and how do you persuade them? Dennis, let's start with you. You're both smiling. Sometimes. You're both smiling like, oh, yeah, I can remember those conversations.
Sometimes it's frustrating. But then when you sit down and you work through what are the issues and you are sitting with the district attorney's office or the attorney general's office and they say, this is what more I need. And that's what you go work on.
Greg, what's that like? I mean, I know that you had multiple conversations about this case in particular, but there are many other cases as well. So what does that feel like when they say, nope, back to the drawing board?
It's frustrating. But if anything, it's a cause for us to go out and work harder on it, put maybe a different set of eyes on it and bring it to a good case to the district attorney's office, so they can't tell you no anymore.
And sure.
With, you know, you have to work on this case legally and according to their wishes and the things that they need done. But it is frustrating. But if anything, it's a more of a drive for us to go out and do a little bit more on it and work harder at it.
And then as a case proceeds to trial, the prosecutor decides, okay, yep, we're going to charge it out. Yep, we're going to work toward trial. How much collaboration is there in the as the process continues between police and prosecutors as you're getting ready for trial? How closely do you all work together, Dennis, when you're getting ready to present this case to a judge or a jury?
For all the major cases, what'll happen is the district or the prosecutor's office will start interviewing witnesses that they plan on bringing to trial. Not necessarily all of them will go there, but you're going to be involved in all of that witness preparation. You're going to be there listening to what the questions are, offering your input if it's relevant. There's a lot of time involved in all of these.
And even after a case, I mean, this trial went, you know, it's not been sentenced out yet. There's talk of a potential appeal. So even though you're both retired, are you still communicating with prosecutors? Are you still involved in the process?
Greg? I am on a regular basis.
You are on a regular basis. What about you, Greg? Are you still involved?
Yes, I'm involved. Smaller scale compared to Detective Blazer. This case, it's still it's a big part of my career, so I'm going to follow the case to the end.
So I guess we'd have to say you're semi retired then at this point, right?
Correct.
as we continue, you're listening to retired Marathon County Sheriff's Investigators Dennis Blazer and Greg Bean on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on police investigations. Coming up, we'll hear about the complexities of missing persons cases, the changing technology in law enforcement, and we'll answer your questions too when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Retired Marathon County Sheriff's Captain Greg Bean and Detective Dennis Blazer are our guests today as we discuss the challenges and changing face of police investigations. What would you like to know? Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. The First 48, a documentary on A&E. My husband loves to watch this program. It's about solving murders, obviously. It claims that the likelihood of solving a homicide decreases by 50% if investigators don't get a lead within the first 48 hours. Dennis, is that really the case?
Pretty much. Most of the homicides that I've investigated, we knew who the suspect was within an hour.
Really? An hour?
Yes.
Okay. So knowing it and proving it are two different things sometimes, yes?
Yes, ma'am.
How do you put the pieces together when you're so certain, but how do you go about connecting that then, Dennis?
It's taken the physical evidence and what the interviews and are telling you and then make it into a report that you can go to the district attorney's office with and say, yes, this is what this person did.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about police work? Greg, I'm curious. I want your take on this. I've heard many officers say it's not like what you see on TV. Well, what do we see on TV that isn't real?
Well, the first thing is it can't be done in an hour. and you're right, Shereen. It's not Hollywood. It's reality. These cases are very detailed and just takes a lot of legwork, a lot of staff, a lot of resources, a lot of what you don't see on TV. So the biggest misconception is that things like this does not happen overnight. As we're talking about the Ken Yedis case, look how long that took to bring it to a somewhat of a conclusion. It just takes a lot of time. And people are used to watching these types of shows on TV where within an hour they got things solved and put away and on to the next show. So it's not like that in the real world.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Yes, I wish it was, but it's not.
What are some things that we see on TV shows that you wish existed, that you wish you could say, yep, we can do this, and that's going to make my life so much easier?
Boy, that's Dennis, you might know more about that one.
One of the things is be able to get a search warrant in under 6 hours.
How long?
And be able to get phone records in less than 3 weeks.
Oh, sure. A lot of it is time then. I mean, really, it sounds like they shorten everything for TV. So, yes, we feel like they can get everything immediately. But does it really take 3 weeks to get phone records?
That's if the phone companies are fast.
Wow. Okay. And how long does it generally take to get a search warrant?
From the time you start typing to the time the judge signs it, generally 6 to 8 hours.
Wow. So it's not instant at all.
No.
I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about missing persons cases. There are frequent notifications that media outlets receive when people go missing. And in most cases, I have to say, we get a notification a couple hours later saying that person has been found. It's pretty quick. But there have been some notable exceptions to that in our area, especially the Stephanie Lowe case in Wausau that was ultimately solved, unfortunately became a murder investigation. The Mackenzie Markin case in Weston, another one that comes to mind, she's still missing. Neither of those were in your jurisdiction directly, but Marathon County was involved, at least tangentially, in the investigation into Kayla Berg's disappearance. Greg, what do you remember about that case?
That's another cold case that we wish was solved. We worked extensively with Anagul Police Department on that case in looking in certain areas around the Wausau area. for her. And again, it takes a lot of time and effort and resources and staff to follow into every lead that comes in on a case like that, especially since it's so old now. And you have different investigators that, we worked one lead a few years ago, and now today you work another lead. It's usually a different investigator who's got to take the time to look into the case a little bit and learn some things about it and then do the legwork. So that's a sad case for this area, for something like that to be happening and her not being located and justice isn't served in a situation like that. It's just,
yeah. Dennis, what happens when a person goes missing? Is it true that you have to wait 24 hours to report a disappearance? What do people do when, hey, my husband didn't come home, or my son didn't come home?
It depends on the circumstances, but they can call right away and start with what the circumstances are, why they believe that the person went missing, if they suspect that foul play is involved. Juvenile runaways, they can be reported right away. One of my standard questions when I was still working the road on any missing person was, did you suspect that there was foul play involved? If they suspected it, well, then investigations division would be involved immediately.
How hard is it to determine whether a person is really missing and not just disappearing of their own volition, especially when it comes to teenage kids who can sometimes behave erratically and run away from home? How do you work to find out that, hey, something is really wrong here, Dennis?
You're talking with mostly the parents. If they suspect that there's foul play involved, well, you also need to start talking with that child's friend or their friends, come up with a game plan on where to look, use a lot of social media, look into their social media to see if they're coming up on it at all, so you can try to figure out where they are.
And we'll talk more about social media a little bit later on. I have some questions about that for you. I'm curious about groups like Rapid Search and Rescue. I'm sure you're familiar with them. They help publicize information for missing person cases. They organize searches. Do those kinds of groups, Greg, what are your thoughts on that? Do they help investigations by helping to spread the word, to organize search parties, or is that something that you're like, hey, man, that's that's our job here?
No, they are a help. It's a resource that we don't mind utilizing. And most of the time the families are in contact with them prior to us, because there are some things that we'd like to get out of the way first or look into before a search of a person, the legwork starts. But when they come on board, it relieves us of that task, as long as it's done properly. And it's a resource that you can't not utilize them, because they're willing to come out. They basically do it for nothing. They're experienced at it, and they have a lot of success stories when they respond and help us help any agency out. So it's a resource that you have to use in situations like that.
So it sounds like Marathon County Sheriff's Department is really open to that. But when I've talked with some of the people from Rapid Search and Rescue, they say that sometimes they try to work with agencies who don't want their help at all. They've just spent a couple of things up in the Northwoods, for example, where they were just told to stay away. Dennis, what would lead an agency to say, please back off, we don't want your help right now?
I would assume that agency has information that they really don't want to share at the time, as it'll affect what the investigation is.
I see. And Greg, what advice would you give to somebody who has a missing loved one? What steps would you take if you come home and realize that someone is gone?
Well, my first advice would be to call immediately.
Immediately.
You had mentioned that I think it's a misconception that you have to wait 24 hours. In some cases, it's nice to wait 24 hours before you put a be on the lookout or something out to look for that person. But if you come home and you have a missing person, family member, or something's just not right, call us immediately, because those cases are worked on right away. It's not like we have to wait 24 hours. Like Dennis said, it depends on the circumstances. You want to get to that case immediately. The probability of finding somebody right away is a lot higher within the first couple hours of that investigation, and to find them alive and well. So the 24-hour thing, it shouldn't even be out there or considered by family or whoever's calling it. They just need to call right away.
Greg, you just mentioned time and how crucial time is, that you need to try to work the first few hours to find that person. Why is time such an important factor here?
Well, to find them safe and sound. Like today, you wouldn't want a person out in the elements for too long, especially if they're elderly or have some type of illness. And actually, today's probably not a bad day temperature-wise, but as we witnessed the last 4 or 5 months, we had a lot of below zero evenings, and nobody would have lasted too long in that type of weather. So the weather is the main condition. Their health, those are the main two. The weather and their health is the reasons why you want to get to it right away. And the investigation itself. If they're utilizing cell phones or some type of technology, or are seen on a business video or something like that, we would be safe to say that we're hot on their trail and making progress in finding them. So the more the time elapses, that goes away.
Dennis, what about time with relation to human trafficking? Is time more critical when you're dealing with a potential human trafficking situation?
Yes, the sooner that you can start tracking where that person went, the better chances you're going to have of success in finding them quickly. If somebody takes a while before they notify you, the person is going to be out of the area in a matter of hours. And the farther away they get from, so if we're dealing with Marathon County, the farther away they get from Marathon County, the harder it's going to be able to track that person. The
Center?
I can't remember what the words are.
National Center for, is it Missing and Exploited Children, or is that?
Yeah, that's it.
Missing. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, them. They're a great resource when we're looking into people that we suspect have become victims of human trafficking. I've had investigations where they tracked one of our local runaways who this girl did intentionally run away from here, but they tracked her down to Atlanta, where then the police were able to find her in Atlanta. She ran away again from down in Atlanta, and then got found again in Oshkosh, and then she was brought back to her family up here eventually.
So human trafficking is not just a big city issue then. How prevalent is that here in Marathon County or even in western Wisconsin in these smaller communities? I mean, do you see it? Would people be surprised at how much there is of that happening, Greg?
I don't think you'd be too surprised that it's certainly here. It's not as prevalent as the big cities in that, at least in my experience. But it happens. It's certainly a concern and needs to be we need to be proactive on cases like that and do our thing online and try to prevent cases like that happening, which I think we were pretty successful on in the years and still are. But nonetheless, it does happen. I'm not familiar. I can't think of any specific case that our department had to work on a case like that, but we've assisted other agencies on them.
Dennis, I want to circle back to something that Greg mentioned a few moments ago. He said issuing a be on the lookout. What does that mean exactly, and what does that entail?
If there's somebody that we're looking for, the communications division will first put out on the radio to the officers that are on our channels within Marathon County that we're looking for a certain individual. Then if it, then dispatch can also send out a TTY or teletype to other agencies and expand it out. Then as we continue out, we can send it out through the Wisconsin Crime Alert Network, and that'll go to different organizations, different people, depending on what organizations we want to give it to. And we just keep expanding it out. It can go out on Crime Stoppers. It can go out on the news organizations, doing press releases. We can just keep expanding it out as we need to.
Investigators Dennis Blazer and Greg Bean, both retired investigators who spent their careers solving crimes with the Marathon County Sheriff's Department, are our guests today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on criminal investigations. Coming up, the ways technology is changing police work and the role of social media. We'd like to hear from you, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guests today are Greg Bean and Dennis Blazer, both retired from the Marathon County Sheriff's Department, for discussion on police investigations. What would you like to know? Email us at route51@wpr.org or join by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. I'm curious about what a day in the life of a law enforcement officer is like. You were both patrol officers at one point. What's it like? You leave your house, kiss your spouse, you head to work. Take me through what a day is like for a police officer. Dennis, what is it?
You can go from nothing to do to total anxiety and terror in a matter of minutes.
Whoa. That sounds pretty intense.
It depends on what comes in. And it depends on what you see.
So
I liked working for the Sheriff's Department because it's a rural agency. We'd be able to go drive out in the countryside, but then you still would get phone or radio messages or calls for service that you're dealing with domestic abuses, you're dealing with high-speed chases. Most of it is mundane, but then it can just flip a coin and it'll change instantly.
Greg, what are the most difficult cases to deal with, even as a patrol officer?
Yeah, people crimes. I kind of had two different sets of crimes, people crimes and property crimes. And, of course, the people crimes are the most difficult because you're dealing with a lot of emotions. You know, when we get called to come into a home, obviously there's something going on, something bad or not so good, and it just rips apart families and things like that. And that's the most difficult to see in my career on working the road and even in investigations. When a homicide or a robbery occurs at a home, it just tears people apart. That's the most difficult one.
Dennis, is it true that domestic incidents are the most dangerous for officers to respond to?
by far, because you're dealing with a lot of unknowns. And then a lot of times, even though the victim called, they don't want to see the other half of the problem be taken away to jail.
Sure. In missing persons cases, well, at really in any case, really, somebody always knows something, right? Somebody knows something that would help. What would you say to somebody who's sitting at home in the recliner and they're wondering if this little tiny bit of information is even worth reporting? I think it's sometimes hard as a citizen to come forward because we might think that our information is too small, maybe not relevant. Greg, what do you say to that?
Yeah, if they're thinking it's just a minor piece of information, it might be major information for us. So they should always call. I think in the past we've made it easier for them to contact us, whether it be by picking up a phone or email or through Crime Stoppers. Anything they can do to get that piece of information to us. Well, you know, the worst that can happen is we take a look at it and it was minor information that probably may not have been necessary. But I know on numerous occasions where people have told us, I wasn't really going to call, but I thought I should. And they called and it turned out it was a major piece of information that helped put cases together.
Curious about your thoughts on social media. Dennis, is social media a help or is it a hindrance when it comes to police investigations?
Both.
Double-edged sword.
Yep. Because where it helps is it helps us track people if we need to. Where it hurts a lot of times, you have somebody you have a crime that's committed, and then you have everybody out on social media putting in what they think is what needs to be done. And they don't know where we are in the investigation, and we're going to be limiting still a lot of the information that we put out. So then you have a lot of rumors and stuff and a lot of frivolous leads that sometimes you have to follow because they're going down different paths.
Sometimes the rabbit hole, right?
Yep.
And coming up with some crazy, crazy things. Do you feel like social media has contributed to crime in any ways? Has it created, say, a haven for child predators, for example? Is that more of a problem because of the way that we interact via social media now and anybody can kind of hide behind their keyboard? Greg, what do you think?
Yes, it's a major highway for crime, whether it be scamming or luring children in or you name it. Before social media, you had street level crimes, where it took some work to commit a crime and lure people in to take them or abuse them or things like that. Now they can do it from their kitchen table on social media, and it became a major highway for crime to happen. And that was one of the main reasons why our department, as you know, Shireen, we built a lab and sought out for staffing it to help us enforce this type of crime.
Let's talk a little bit about that regional forensics lab. I've been in there, and it's fascinating to see what happens behind the scenes. How did that come to be? How did that develop and become what it is today?
Again, that didn't happen overnight neither. It's just we found out we needed some more resources in our area as far as technology. We went out and got a detective position to staff a lab. And I think you were in the lab when we took two offices and made it a lab. And I don't know the specific time frame, but it was within years we had to expand that lab and add more computers and things to it to keep up with the times. But I don't know how law enforcement can get by without a resource like that, whether you're utilizing the states or the federal forensic labs. We were pretty glad to see we had a lot of support in building that lab and staffing it, and it helps tremendously in solving cases and getting things done in a timely period instead of waiting for other agencies that you would have to utilize to get the information you need. So a huge, huge success for this area is that lab. And it was nice to get another staff member to put in there, because even though you have the technological parts of these investigations now, you still have the old time investigative part as well. So that part didn't go away when this technology came about. They came together basically, and you still had to hit both parts of it. So it's
sure. Dennis, what kinds of things do they do in the forensics lab? How that help you as you investigate things? Specifically, what kinds of techniques do they use that can help?
They're able to go into computers and phones to get data out of them. It'll help place where people are. When I would be investigating fatal crashes, we would always want to get the occupants' phones to see what was going on. It was that phone part of the problem, what caused the crash. We would be looking to see in the data if there's information in there on another type of crime years ago when we first started doing this. With our forensic lab, we had a phone that was downloaded as investigating a burglary, and we were able to find within the metadata where they typed in the address for the house that we were, where the burglary was, and that was the part of it that led us to being able to get the person charged and ultimately convicted for that burglary.
Greg, I want to ask you to talk about the National Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force program. I know Marathon County started participating in that quite some years ago. Can you explain what that is and what's the role?
We joined in with them, number one, for the training that they offered, and number two, for the resources they offered. It was a huge agency that we could rely on to help us in these technological type crimes, and the main benefit of it was sending our troops to the training that they offered to get us on board with the new types of investigations that we saw coming.
And the task force has been responsible for bringing many child predators to justice here in Wisconsin. There have been multiple stings. What's it like to be behind the scenes during one of those task force investigations? What does it feel like?
Well, certainly a wake-up call. To, you know, you would like to think that things like that don't happen in this area, but it obviously does. And we've had some pretty long evenings where we brought in sometimes 8 to 12 people in one sting operation that were out there trying to connect with underage kids to have sex with them. Just a wake-up call, which prompted us, you know, that was one of the main reasons to build that lab and to regionalize and to get a multi-agencies involved in things like that to help fight this and be proactive with it. So it was a wake-up call. It's surprising on how many arrests we had.
Local police also received tips from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children when child pornography is detected online. Dennis, how has that changed the way that police catch child predators?
it ends up that NCMEC is able to provide the IP address of where the person is that's in possession of the child porn. And then it's just basic police work. Start writing warrants for records to track where that person is. Then once you go, or you know who it is, where it is, well, then it's a case of just go talk with the person and searches electronic devices. And then,
so it gives you leads that you didn't necessarily have before and ways to trace.
Right.
Trace.
You wouldn't know where to even to go without NCMEC.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're on the subject of technology, I'm also wondering about the advances in technology with DNA databases, for example. Greg, how's that changed law enforcement?
Well, anything new techniques like that is always a bonus to us. It helped considerably in solving a lot of cold cases, and pinpointing suspects or criminals to where it gives us a good lead on who we can continue to look for and search for. So it's a technology that when it came around, it obviously was a lot of work, but it paid off because it was one that took over the old-fashioned fingerprint.
Sure.
Type cases. DNA was obviously more accurate and pinpointed the person to a T. So excellent resources.
Obviously, there's a lot that has changed in the world of law enforcement, but what hasn't changed? I mean, what are some things that you think will always stay the same when it comes to investigating crime? Dennis?
You have to be able to talk with people and get the story.
What about you, Greg? What do you think will always stay the same when it comes to police work?
Well, the good old-fashioned legwork into an investigation will never go away. even though you have the technology and new tools and new resources that you can utilize, you still have to have the boots on the ground, so to say. You have to respond to the crime scene. You have to process it. Certainly the technology makes it more accurate and things like that, but you're always going to have the boots on the ground. You still have to have the staff members to do that, and I don't ever foresee that ever going away.
You know, Greg, you've talked about some of the things that you've seen during the task force investigations. Dennis, you talked about fatal crashes. Both of you have seen so many things that people do to one another. Greg alluded to that as well. I'm curious, Dennis, how do you cope with that? How do you manage your mental health when you've seen the worst of what people can do to one another?
You have to talk with people. Can't keep it in all the time.
Greg, what do you think is the best way to deal with it?
I would agree with Dennis. You can't let it build up inside of you, and you have to have your support. And I think a lot of us do. My support is my family and coworkers that help you get through day to day. So without that, it'd be tough.
What about, you just have a few seconds left. I just have to ask you, Dennis, what was the most memorable of your career, the most memorable case that you've ever worked on?
It was a person that was threatening to commit suicide that when I got him in my squad car and I was driving him back up to the healthcare center and we talked, and he thanked me for talking. And then a couple of years later, I heard on the radio where he was thinking about committing suicide again.
Wow.
And he said he wasn't going to because of the conversation that he had before with the deputy.
Thank you for sharing that. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. A sincere thanks to our guests, Dennis Blazer and Greg Bean. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer, who is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@WPR.org. Until next week, we're headed out of town.